Welcome to Criminal Sexual Conduct, What Needs to Change. This four-hour documentary is supported by a grant from the Corporation of Public Broadcasting and is co-produced by WUVS LP and Connie Nesbury International LLC. RAIN statistics report that an American is sexually assaulted every 98 seconds, and every 8 minutes that victim is a child. Meanwhile, only 6 out of every 1,000 perpetrators are sentenced to prison. According to the Crime Victims Center, 1 in 3 girls and 1 in 6 boys are sexually assaulted before the age of 18. It is estimated that there are 60 million survivors of child sexual abuse in America. High rates of depression, anxiety, substance abuse, dissociative disorders, interpersonal dysfunction, sexual problems, and suicidal ideation have all been identified to varying degrees among men and women who survive child sexual abuse. Through conversations with survivors and experts, we explore solutions to the pandemic of criminal sexual conduct, while recognizing that this is a global issue. Our hope is that this program will raise awareness of the issues, promote compassion through understanding, and encourage conversations in communities about what changes need to be made so that everyone is safer from criminal sexual conduct. This is Connie Nesbury, your moderator. For statistics or support, call the RAIN hotline at 800-656-4673 or visit their website at RAIN.org. That's RAINN.org. For full speaker bios and transcripts of this broadcast, visit ConnieNesbury.com. That's ConnieNesbary.com. This hour, entitled Changing Our Language and Culture, features attorney Rebecca O'Connor, Vice President of Public Policy at RAIN, the Rape and Incest National Network. Sunshine O'Connor, who is a survivor and author of a series of books in the Damsel in Defense line, designed to help parents and children talk about situations and how to navigate them. And Ebony Tucker, JD, serving as Advocacy Director at the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence. Rebecca, tell us what you do at your job.
Sure. So I'm the Vice President of Public Policy here at RAIN, which is a fancy way of saying I'm the lobbyist who has the pleasure of going to Capitol Hill and state legislatures and the like to raise awareness about issues of sexual violence and also help move the needle and change, as need be, the system and create stronger supports for survivors of these crimes.
I noticed on your website you have a list of all the different statutes in different states, so people can get a lot of information there?
Yes, absolutely. We have a compendium of states' laws in our state law database, which is developed in partnership with the law firm of Hogan Lovells, which provides that as a pro bono service to us. We there provide everything from your state's definitions of rape, sexual violence, etc., to whether or not HIV testing is required of certain offenders, how consent looks in legal terminology. And we do our best to distill that information into translatable non-legalese so that folks from any background can understand where their state stands on the issues and where there's room for improvement, and can also use our tool to compare up to 4 states' laws on a particular topic or a number of topics and create a report.
And when was RAIN formed?
We were formed about 23 years ago by our current president and founder, Scott Berkowitz, back in the 90s when we realized that there was a need for a new way of serving survivors and ensuring that they had access to timely support and assistance in the wake of sexual violence. And that's what really led them to create what is our foundation, which is the National Sexual Assault Hotline at 800-656-HOPE, and online at the website I mentioned, RAIN.org, which is 24/7 free and confidential to anyone who wants to avail themselves of some support. We do our best to meet people where they are and then connect them to our partners on the state level. We partner with state sexual assault service providers from around the country to make sure that if someone wants a more in-depth experience of support, whether it be counseling or legal advocacy, we can connect them with a soft handoff to someone within their own jurisdiction that can help.
I have been interviewing a lot of survivors who have not had a good experience with law enforcement. Is there something you want to say about that?
Yeah. You know, every individual is going to have their own expectations and experience when they engage with anybody in the system, including law enforcement. And, you know, to those that have had a negative experience, I would say don't let that taint your entire view of that system and the actors within it. We've made a lot of progress through concerted efforts informed by survivors, frankly, and other advocates to make sure that people understand things like what trauma can do to someone's brain, what one of these experiences can mean to someone, and how it impacts their ability to storytell, for instance, in a linear fashion, and to seek out that help, and what a brave choice they're making by putting themselves out there and reporting these crimes. And, you know, we need survivors that feel comfortable and feel confident coming forward to the system. And so ultimately, I would say, share your feedback to the extent that you're comfortable doing so, that you feel safe doing so, so that we can all better learn how to amend our behaviors in the system, but also help others understand how it is they may be chilling people from coming forward and feeling supported throughout the process.
Essentially, don't give up.
Exactly. Because for every one bad experience, I can guarantee there are people that are working diligently day in, day out. We work with law enforcement routinely who really, really do understand, want to be there to support you as they investigate these crimes and can help cross-pollinate the information that's going to make the system better overall.
That's good to hear. Why do you think criminal sexual conduct is underreported?
Ultimately, and succinctly, I think the system historically hasn't been one that has been receptive to the realities of sexual violence and its impact on survivors. In other words, as I alluded to earlier, there are times when a survivor may present in a particular manner with a particular affect, a flat affect, for instance, or is unable to tell a story the same way twice, and they've been disbelieved or didn't present in a way that was expected. And I think that that perpetuated myths about the nature of these crimes and who reports them and why. Over time, especially in recent decades, I think we've learned so much more about the neurobiology of trauma, about how these crimes occur, about who perpetrates these crimes, that it isn't the old stranger in the bushes myth, that these are people's acquaintances more often than not, and that it can happen to anyone in any facet of our society. And so I think for a lot of survivors, historically, they see things like headlines about backlog evidence across the country and the fact that rape kits aren't tested or the fact that a survivor is called out as making false claims. And that tells them that this system isn't going to take them seriously. So why put themselves on the line in that way after such an intense personal experience to begin with? And unfortunately, that's been a pattern for some time in our country. However, I will say that, you know, even in my short period of time working within this realm, relative to the big picture, I've seen things transform, and a lot of the positive changes that have happened, the education that is so necessary for everyone around what these crimes mean, what they do to an individual, what they mean to our ability to keep our public safe, has really changed the way that we as a country think about and respond to these crimes. And we're seeing a shift, but it's, as with many cultural shifts, it's been slow going.
What do you think is the extent of the problem? I know you have a lot of statistics, but when so many people don't report, how do we know what percent of the statistics are really just part of the problem?
Oh, that's a great question. I could sit here and spew off every stat in the book, but at the end of the day, they are numbers. Now, I will say that there's a lot of rigorous data collection happening at the governmental levels and also just individuals working within the field and doing what they can to get a pulse of what's happening, where it's happening, how it's happening, et cetera. I think ultimately, you don't have to go to the hard data to have a conversation that will reveal just how widespread incidents of sexual violence are in our country. Often you say to someone that you work in this field and immediately you see a glimmer of recognition cross their face, and it may be immediate and it may be down the road that they say to you, you know, I knew someone that that happened to, or that I thought it might have been abuse or what have you. And so we can go to the hard data, and of course that's so invaluable to the work that we do, and we need to increase what we have and really dig deeper into the data to understand where it is that we're succeeding and where maybe there are some additional shortcomings in how we're responding to and preventing these crimes. But at the end of the day, all you have to do is talk to others, open your ears, and listen, and you'll see that this is a pervasive issue that touches every single part of our society.
You know, we're talking here about criminal sexual conduct, so that includes child sexual abuse, human trafficking. There's all different kinds of forms of sexual assault. What do you think we need to do to stop this in our society?
There's no one-size-fits-all solution to this, but I do think one of the things that I've seen happening but we need to continue to have happen is shifting this from a taboo topic to something that everyone acknowledges is a reality of our day-to-day existence, unfortunately, as a society, and not shying away from the difficult conversations that that yields, whether it be talking about things frankly and in a way that will help prevent future perpetration by talking at the earliest possible opportunities to our children, to teachers, to parents about how to look out for these things and respond if it does happen. Of course, not victim blaming, but making sure that people are equipped to recognize certain signs. And also just heightened vigilance and awareness about how every person, whether you're, you know, wearing my shoes as a lobbyist going to Congress, or you're on the sidelines and you're perhaps a volunteer coach in a little league team, or a teacher, of course, or even a medical provider, you have a role and responsibility in helping us as a society reform this and change the way that sexual violence is occurring in our nation. And it's up to people like us who are on the front lines and working in this issue every single day to bring those tools to the people that can really help us make a change, whether it's changes in policy and the very concrete legislative changes that sort of rule how we behave, or just changing the way that we even talk about and normalize some of this behavior that is criminal in nature but has historically been blown off as, well, that's just, and I'm just using an example, boys being boys or what have you. And at the end of the day, it's about people. And it's about making sure that we're protecting Americans, and particularly vulnerable Americans, including children and the disabled.
What else do you think needs to change?
You know, I can give you examples of laws that need to change. But again, I think I go back to that overarching mentality that this doesn't happen to us or me, or it only happens in certain areas of the country or to certain people, or, you know, if someone behaves in a certain way, they subject themselves to this. That just has to be eliminated. I mean, we don't even think about whether or not you click a seatbelt on anymore. And that was a culture shift, because when I was a kid, you did. You know, sometimes you just sat there without your seatbelt. But something has to shift in our society so that, and I think it's happening, to be honest. I think that a lot of high-profile incidents, for better or for worse, have brought this to the fore and really shifted the way we talk about some of these things. But I think we have to get to the zero tolerance level and really recognize and be willing to talk about the various forms, as you said, that this violence can take, that it isn't all the traditional someone was raped in a violent manner with force or a weapon or what have you, and recognize that what some people may view as just normalized behavior of a teenager sending around a video of someone and what they did to them when they were passed out, that Snapchat, things like that, that we can't accept that. And if we do fall backward in that regard, then everything else we're doing will be for naught. We have to, as a society, demand change.
What are some consequences you see of untreated sexual abuse?
The consequences are vast when someone isn't given the opportunity to properly heal. They're psychological, they're physical. We know that there's heightened potential for things like alcohol and drug abuse, sort of the visible consequences, lost productivity, ability to engage in day-to-day activity like work, etc. But then there's also just the personal loss of, and I say this having stood side by side with survivors for years to share their stories, the loss of self-worth and a feeling that you can trust the systems that you traditionally have trusted to take care of you, to make sure that bad things aren't happening not only to you but to the others in society. And so there's so much to be lost and yet so much to be gained with even the smallest changes that we make, like educating stakeholders across the board about why we don't immediately judge somebody based on how they're dressed at the time something happens or whether they had a drink. And so it's an easy cost-benefit analysis. We can lose so much and yet we gain so much with small change.
I've researched how these behaviors were dealt with in other cultures. In Africa, they have Ubuntu. And Native American societies historically have had restorative justice circles. Both are very similar, and mainly because in all cultures, we cannot afford to lose the talents or skills of individual members while still holding them accountable for their actions. I'm bringing these ideas into the question of what consequences do you think need to be in place for perpetrators?
That's a great question. Wow. And I didn't know that about Native American society. Well, I think from Rain's perspective, there is a strong, it's not the entire solution, but there is a strong value in ensuring that perpetrators of these crimes are criminally held responsible for those actions. Now, what that means can be varied, right? Whether or not that means prison time plus some other form of paying back your debt to society or seeking out certain counseling, et cetera. But at the end of the day, that's been one of our primary focuses, mainly because we know that only a fraction of people will ever face criminal responsibility for these acts. And in part, of course, there's the public safety aspect of that, but also there's a message that sends back to survivors and to others to say, you know, It was a nasty thing they did, but let's just give them a slap on the wrist and walk the other way and let them go on with their lives. I think recently a judge spoke of a sexual predator as someone who was a good man or a good citizen. And so that accountability, although not the only answer, is at the end of the day part of a broader message back to society and to potential perpetrators, but also to survivors, that we hear you. We take these crimes as seriously as you do. This isn't just a random behavior. This is a criminal act that has done harm, and we need to hold them accountable just like we would anybody that acts in such a manner. You know, we've done a lot of work with educating the public and making sure that at every opportunity we can, we bring people who have learned from past mistakes and behavior to the table to talk about these issues and to talk about, as you said, what happened here? What are the roots of this choice that someone makes to behave in this manner? We don't know enough about that. We need more research into what it is that causes someone to act criminally. Now, a lot of people would say, well, we already know that's just who they are. But I do think it's a nuanced conversation, as is the what is the appropriate punishment conversation. I don't want to minimize the role of the criminal justice system, even as I acknowledge that there also are other avenues I recognize that may lead to and promote both healing for the survivor and a change in the way that these crimes are committed.
What is Rain's primary focus right now?
First of all, getting more cases reported. I mean, that's part of why they're not getting charged. We have a system where victims don't feel comfortable coming forward, right? So we need to fix it and then identify the different ways and also give the tools to the prosecutors and others to investigate these cases and understand the various dynamics and how individual cases vary, but the common denominators are sometimes the same.
What's the most important message that Rain wants to get across?
Well, I would say a couple things. One is, first and foremost, if you are a survivor or something has happened to you, we believe you, and we are here to support you in whatever form you need and to help you connect to the resources you need. Beyond that, if I'm talking to an audience where it's policymakers, I can't emphasize enough that for as much progress as we've made, and it's significant on both the state and the federal level, there is still change that needs to happen to make the system one where victims are going to feel confident and comfortable coming forward and reporting these crimes, and that we're really going to change the numbers on sexual violence in a meaningful way. And ultimately, I think people just need to remember that this is an issue that, again, can't be hidden, can't be overlooked when you're talking about the broader landscape of what's plaguing society. It impacts every aspect of our lives, whether we realize it before it impacts it directly or not. So public health, public safety, if we're not doing everything we can to support survivors of these violent crimes, then we're doing a disservice to society, and we're hurting more than one individual in the process. We're hurting all of us.
I don't know about you, but I'm feeling really hopeful right now because I know that you go through storms before you get to the rainbow. You go through chaos before things get better. And
yeah.
So I feel like that's kind of where we're at right now. A lot of things are coming out, and that's scaring people. But to me, it's like, oh, there's the hope.
Absolutely. No, I love that you said that. After we finish this call, I'll be going to Capitol Hill, and I'm excited about that meeting and the ones that follow because, as you said, for every negative headline, for every step backward that we seem to take on this issue, I can personally attest to the change and transformation that I've seen in just the way that we talk about these issues and the willingness to talk about it openly. We should seize this moment and this opportunity.
Thanks so much for your time. Sunshine, I'm really glad you could be here today, and I want to hear more about Damsel in Defense and what you're doing.
Thank you. Damsel in Defense is a direct sales company that kind of fell in my lap right at the perfect time when I was feeling strong enough that my story could maybe help other people. And we sell self-defense tools like stun guns and pepper sprays, but the most important part of it is the education piece that comes along with it. And through Damsel in Defense, I really got to see kind of the other side of becoming a survivor when you get to hear somebody's story for the first time because they are finally opening up because they have an intimate space to do that. It made it just a really fulfilling business for me. They approached me to help brainstorm a children's line, and we put a bunch of ideas on the wall and decided that some books would be really, really great because the one thing that I was missing from my childhood that would have kind of changed my trajectory was validation to continue talking. And we took a bunch of scenarios that kids can find themselves in that we call tricky situations, and we created a series of books that tackle those with safe ways to navigate through them to hopefully start having those conversations happen in people's homes. Because my goal is to empower an entire generation to stop abuse.
And part of that is by having the children know that it's okay not to keep secrets anymore.
Absolutely. We very strongly emphasize that you keep talking to your safe adults until somebody hears you.
That's great. Do you want to say more about the Safe Hearts books?
Yes, actually, the Safe Hearts books for me were almost the biggest piece in my healing journey because it was kind of like I got to revisit that child who was silenced and kind of work through that. And when we released our test run of the books before they were released to the public, the few families that we released them to, I saw a huge impact on them. There was one mom who is a survivor and was terrified to talk to her kids about things because she was afraid of what to do if anything had happened to them. And it gave her the strength start working through her healing process and start talking to her kids. And that happened like 3 or 4 times on our test run. And we realized that even if we never sold a single book when they released, that they're already doing amazing work in people's lives. We released 2 of them to start, and every 6 months there will be 2 more. Right now we have 4 available, and they released in January and July. 2 more will come out each time. We have 10 finished, and I'm really excited about the future because we've seen through the 4 books that we've released, we've seen so much feedback from how many lives have been changed just by these simple little children's books that we know we're in this for the long haul and we have to continue.
How many authors do you have there that work on the books?
I am the author of the book, and we have a child psychologist that goes over them to make sure that they're clinically correct. We also have a collaboration of our entire team that put together a parent guide. So that way if a parent reads a book to a child and then the child starts talking, the parent doesn't freeze and not know what to do. It can help walk them through what their next steps are and some other role-playing things that to do in the home and scenarios that aren't covered in the book. So it's really comprehensive. The website where you can go to order the books is yourdamseldiva.com, and they are available for sale, and you can check what each book is about. We have a book about public bathroom safety, a grooming coach, a big brother who tries to be inappropriate to his little sister's friend, and we have a book about a new neighbor girl that moves in and wants to be a little bit inappropriate in her play with our main character girl. So we're tackling some of those situations that are really, really tough and awkward, and people don't like to explore them at all, but we've done it in a way that makes sense to little kids and also makes it really easy to have that conversation continue in the home. We have these 4 characters that are called the Heart Defenders. And when they sense that a heart is in danger, they jump into action, and one of the characters gets sent into the scenario to help the main character of the book work through it and make the right choice and be courageous. And those 4 characters are kind of the thing that stays the same through every single book. It's just the scenarios and the other characters that change.
Your books sound wonderful and so needed. Sunshine, do you want to say a little about your own story as well?
Yeah. I am a survivor of child sexual abuse from my biological father that started before I can remember. We have traced it back to late infancy, early toddlerhood through medical records when it started. And I learned how to be the perfect silent, invisible child, because I felt a really strong need to protect my mother, because obviously when, you know, when there's an abuser, there are usually threats, and I took those very seriously because I was a tiny kid. It wasn't until I was 12 years old that I spoke up, and I had already been sent away to live with family, because when I hit 11, I went completely out of control and got into drugs and alcohol, and my biological father at that point was not the only person who abused me. I came out about my biological father when I was living with my aunt and uncle, and it was really hard because that was a time where I don't feel like therapists had good training on how to handle that situation with the correct language that wasn't shaming. They treated me like I was just making something up and telling stories. And finally, they called the police, and the police showed up, and my mom asked him if he had done it, and he immediately confessed that he had. And that was my blessing, because just to have her immediately believe me solidified that maybe I was going to be okay. However, through my teenage years, I was not okay, and I continued to get myself into these crazy situations where I would just be taken advantage of or forced into sex, and that didn't stop until I was an adult. When I was 29 years old, I was abducted and held against my will for an entire day. And he told me that he was going to kill me. And I don't know what on earth changed his mind, but he let me go. And I ran home to my kids and I hugged them. And I realized that the one common denominator in all of this was me. And it wasn't because it was my fault. It was because I didn't know what I was supposed to be doing and what I was supposed to be looking for. So I spent a long time learning about abuse and the cycle of abuse and living as a victim and continuing to fall into those traps, and realized that I really needed to fortify myself and started rebuilding myself. And I became a victim's advocate. And through helping other people, I found this little company called Damsel in Defense at just the perfect time. And that has really been the catalyst for me to use my story to help people realize that when you're hiding in the dark and in the shame of abuse and not understanding why these things continue to happen, like, I always hear people say, it's like I have a target on my back. And just to be able to free them from that train of thought and let them feel like they're not alone and that they're okay, and to hear them tell their story for the first time and really to watch the birth happen between being a victim and being born as a survivor has been the most incredible healing thing that I could possibly be any part of. And I love it so much.
It's so wonderful that you founded Damsels in Distress. It's a wonderful way to take your energy to help yourself and to help other people at the same time. I want to highlight, too, how important it was that your mother validated you and believed you. Those two things are huge.
Very huge.
It's like when you're abused as a child, it's almost like you've lost your radar for what to watch out for in situations.
Absolutely. It's almost like when you are in the cycle of abuse, you are attracted to people who are abusive because you haven't learned that boundaries are okay and acceptable and what sort of things that are grooming behaviors. You don't know any of that. And you only see it as love because that's what you were taught when you were a tiny kid, that this is what love is.
Why do you think criminal sexual conduct is underreported?
I feel like it is underreported because people who are abused are shamed into believing that it's their fault and that nobody will believe them, and they're afraid of what happens. Because when you say so-and-so is abusing me, you know that the entire world, as everybody around you knows it, is going to change and it's going to be different. And I really feel like the shame and the fear that your abuser puts inside of you really holds you back, because nobody is excited to say that I'm being abused. It's really, really hard. And a lot of times people don't believe you. And sometimes it's not even necessarily that they don't believe you. It's that they don't honestly know what to do. So they just do nothing.
You know, they say there's fight, flight, or freeze. It's like they go into the freeze mode themselves.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I also feel that the way that law enforcement handles things is improving very slowly, but it is really hard to be a victim and go through the process. When I was 16, I went to a party and I was dragged off into the woods by a grown-up man. And if you look back and you look at what happened, it looks very cut and dry. I had rocks in my back. My clothes were covered in blood. Everything looked very much like, yes, she got dragged off into the woods and this man raped her. But the police officers were very uncomfortable. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to ask questions. The people at the hospital were very almost cold, because it was like they were just going through the motions of, oh, here's a rape kit, let's crack this open, we're going to do this. And it felt very, very shaming. And the worst part of that whole situation was that one of the detectives, who was a female, came to school to observe how I was doing. And what she didn't know, had she taken the time to maybe interview me a little bit, was that I was a professional victim. Something terrible could happen to me the night before, and the next day you would not have any idea, because I did not blur those lines between my actual life and the life where bad things happen.
Well, you had already been trained before by your father to not show it.
Absolutely. And so she reported that I was at school going to my classes the very next day, appearing to be 100% fine, which I was. However, that didn't change what this man did, and that case was thrown out. So the next time something happened, I didn't report it. And the next time something happened, I didn't report it, because I didn't want to go through all of that extra trauma, knowing that the outcome was probably not going to be in my favor anyway.
Right. Rain has statistics that out of every 1,000 rapes, only 6 perpetrators end up in jail.
It's terrible. It's awful. And it's a battle that not very many of us are willing to pick up our weapons and go to war for, but we have to in order to make change. Otherwise, there's always going to be someone hiding behind the dark corner.
You wanted to talk about changing the language that law enforcement and the court systems use. What did you mean by that?
So the language, when I went through my thing when I was 16, they did not use words that made me feel any less shameful than I already felt. It felt like I was a disgusting blob in the corner that they didn't really know how to deal with. One of the things that they're working on in the Portland area, especially with victims of human trafficking, is changing the language to victim-sensitive language. And that means completely going in and retraining how police officers see sexual assault or human trafficking, and teaching them how to speak to a victim who has been brutalized in a way that they're almost handling them with kid gloves, instead of treating them like they were getting pulled over for driving 10 miles over the speed limit. One of the big problems that we face, especially with human trafficking, because human trafficking is sexual assault in like the worst form, because it happens for money over and over and over again. And for a long time, those girls were arrested and treated as criminals, and their language they used towards them was criminal language. So we're really trying hard to come up with language that is not shameful and that can hold space around a victim that has just gone through something terrible, so that they can have an opportunity to tell what happened and to receive help in a way that doesn't further damage them or shame them or victim blame them. And that's, you know, really hard, because a lot of these guys that are on the force have been on the force for a long time, and they see, you know, the worst 1% of everybody. And it's hard for them to find that flip in how they treat people who are truly victims and not make them feel like they're the worst people in the world.
They tend to make judgments and assumptions right away, too, and have a biased viewpoint. Yeah.
It's really, really hard. Mm-hmm. And it takes almost an act of Congress to even get someone to listen to the idea that maybe some language might be changed.
What else do you think needs to happen so that we can stop criminal sexual conduct?
We really need to spread awareness and education. It's something that nobody wants to hear, nobody wants to talk about, nobody wants to slow down and look at it. But if we don't educate every single person, then it's just going to continue to happen, and the statistics are going to continue to rise, because we can't have that mentality that we just look the other way, that these things are happening.
What have been some of the consequences of your abuse in your own life? How much has it cost you?
I am nearing the end of my second marriage. Relationships are hard. Choosing a person who isn't going to hurt you more is hard. Learning how to be okay in your own skin is very hard. It took me a lot of years to realize that I don't have to always just be a sexual being, that it's okay for me to be all of the other things that a woman should get to be. And that tore me down from the inside because I ended up in situations I didn't want to be in, doing things that I didn't really want to do because it was really all that I knew. It's affected every single facet of my life in one way or another. But when I look at my progression of healing, I have succeeded because I have these books out there that are helping thousands of people right now. And I am still coming to terms with it's okay for me to be taken seriously as a professional because what happened to me does not define who I am.
What have you done to heal that's been helpful for you?
I have found that my best healing comes when I surround myself with other people who are a little bit farther on the healing path than I am. We have a saying in Damsel in Defense that healed hearts heal hearts. And a lot of us, we're all in different spots on our journey. I do have a therapist that I see, you know, because it's hard when you hear a lot of stories. You can be triggered by it. You can be affected by it. And those are kind of my two healing things is my therapist and my people who are also healing. We're healing together.
In community, that's great.
Absolutely.
What's the most important thing that you would like people to know?
If you see something, say something. And if somebody brings something to you, even if you just want to freeze and not do anything, do something. Because in order for change to really happen, we have to take action. And when we educate ourselves and we take action, that's when we stop things from happening and start people on the process of healing.
And I think what you're saying, too, is that people need to trust their instincts.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Absolutely. Our brains are supercomputers, and they're pretty darn smart, and our instincts are kind of them telling us what we're not noticing.
Thanks a lot for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you for yours.
We are talking with Ebony Tucker today from the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence. And Ebony, tell us a little about what your organization does.
So our organization works on sexual assault policy at the federal level, as well as working with states on their own sexual assault policy and legislation. I'm the advocacy director based here in D.C., and so a lot of the work that I do is really around looking at some of the issues that can become legislation, ways that legislation that is being introduced could be impactful, ways that we could improve some of those things, and also trying to prepare some of our partners at the state level for what we're seeing as federal legislation that could be coming into their arenas.
And I know a lot of states are looking at eliminating the statute of limitations. Are there other issues that your organization is looking at?
We're working a lot on issues related to communities of color, to making sure that individuals who are LGBTQ, who have disabilities, that we are trying to make sure that we are seeing all different types of survivors and that we really are making sure that legislation that we're supportive of and also policy initiatives that we're working on really are inclusive of what survivors look like across the country.
Why do you think criminal sexual conduct is so underreported?
It's something that we have kept so secret. I think a part of that is that our victim blaming as a society, our inability to have honest conversations and making sure that people are comfortable having those conversations, especially when we're looking at youth-on-youth sexual violence. We have stigmatized sex in a lot of ways that it's very difficult, I think, for people, especially young ones, can talk about this. You can say things that you are uncomfortable with. You can say that things have happened when you've been told that sex is something inappropriate to talk about all of the time. We see that with adults, particularly women, our sense of victim blaming and this idea that women were supposed to have prevented their own sexual assault is very pervasive in our society. If you create an environment that is so unwelcoming to those who need help, then of course no one is going to tell.
What do you think is the extent of the problem?
I think it's hard for any of us to say. I think that we know that the numbers are extremely high, but I think because reporting is so difficult, the concern is always how many more people than what we're able to capture in these numbers. Anyone who was sexually assaulted at a younger age and then now is disclosing, when you experience it, you know that there have to be so many people who aren't telling you currently, that being able to decipher what the actual numbers are is really difficult. We've allowed a situation to fester. We've allowed this to continue where no one is comfortable saying anything, so that gives power to the abuser.
Is your organization working on military sexual assault?
We have been definitely engaged before with military initiatives. The military has definitely put the effort in to make some of those changes. I think that it's still a struggle because of the culture that we talked about throughout society is very prevalent within the military. And when you're talking about trying to change the way sexual assault is seen in systems, you really have to have that support from the top down. There has to be this idea that the commanding officer thinks this is important, so we're all going to go to this meeting, or we're all going to make sure that we are responsive to survivors, that we offer helpful services. And that's a big culture shift for them, and one that's going to take a lot of work.
Yeah, it's definitely a different culture all to its own.
So I was going to say, I think that not specifically about the military, but just what applies to the military in a very team, club, like all of these things, that very strong sense of protecting each other, respecting chain of command, all of those things can really be difficult when trying to create a supportive air for sexual assault survivors. And I think that really looking at your processes and making sure that you're changing what's necessary, that you're being responsive to make sure that you're creating a system that was put in place without thinking about this issue, but making sure that now that your system can be amended to do so.
And when we're thinking about the transgender community, how are their issues different?
A lot of the conversations we've had around that have been in a couple of key areas. So, for instance, law enforcement issues are very significant when we're talking about that, because law enforcement response, like the response of many within our society when it comes to issues in the transgender community, have not been there as open or accepting or understanding as they should have been. So when people walk into situations with a bias already, it really affects the kind of care and support that a survivor receives. It can also affect issues around health, issues around economic status, and all of those things together can really affect the way that you are received, the likelihood that you're going to be sexually assaulted, the way that you're supported to do report, your ability to report, your access to reporting systems, and what that looks like. So I think that all of those things are a bit more difficult. As we see higher rates of trans minors who are suffering from issues or from homelessness, then we're going to see higher rates of sexual assault there. If we're seeing that law enforcement is less likely to pursue cases that are brought by trans minors, then you're going to see lower rates of reporting. There's always a sort of counteracting to whatever the problem is.
What solutions does the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence consider as promising at this time?
The most promising ideas right now is working on a stronger prevention programming for youth. And that's most likely because the greatest success in treatment or prevention work does come from youth as opposed to with adults. And I don't think that we think that working with adults should be abandoned at all, but it's one of those you're trying to grab what's most successful right now. So working on treatment programs for juvenile sex offenders is an issue that has some really promising initiatives moving around it. As a society, we spend quite a bit of money on the sex offender registry for youth and not enough money on actually trying to treat and prevent future criminal sexual behavior, especially when we're talking about young adults who have offended maybe once or twice. I think also we're very supportive of prevention programming in schools and really trying to have conversations about consent and also making sure that young men and women have the ability to have healthy relationships with each other and interact appropriately. We are definitely supportive of those kinds of initiatives.
Let's talk a little more about child sexual abuse prevention and what else could be done.
This idea of teaching children to police their own sexual assault or sexual abuse is extremely dangerous. It's not intentional, but it still has the effect of victim blaming for an even younger group of people. We don't want to create an air where children are afraid to say something, but also putting it on us as adults to create a more appropriate environment for children and to make sure that they're safer is the direction that we need to be going.
What would you say about consequences for perpetrators?
We are at an interesting point in our history in having the conversations about criminal justice because we have put so much focus into punishment without really thinking about treatment, about accountability. I don't think punishment in a lot of these cases is deserved, and I don't think treatment is something that works on everyone. This idea that everyone can be treated successfully, I don't think is accurate. But I also think that accountability is so important. And when you're talking about some of the other cultures, it's about trying to help a person understand what it is that they've done, how they've affected someone's life, what that means. Having to say to the person, this is what I've done to you. I know what I am. I know what this has been. I don't think we have very many things like that at all because we've developed a system that was so married to the idea of punishment. But then, you know, you might serve 10 or 15 years for rape and have no sense of morally what's taking place or what's happened.
There's no resolution.
Yeah, there's no resolution there. One of the first things you'll see on the Florida Constitution when it comes to the criminal justice system is that the purpose of the Florida criminal justice system is to punish, not to rehabilitate. And that's significant. It lets you know what culture you're working in that doesn't understand that we put very angry, punished people back into our system. We want to protect people, but we put them back into our society, and how is anyone protected there?
Right. They're even more angry then. I think it stems from seeing perpetrators as monsters, as evil. No, they're human beings too. We need to figure out what's going on with them and how we can turn that around.
Yeah. And we've had a lot of discussions about this here, and I think it's been supportive of a lot of that work of not seeing people as people who are sex offenders as monsters who have been outcast from society. Because obviously it's not good for them, but it's not good for us. We've seen that in places with residency restrictions, and we've seen some trouble there as well. You can't expel people. You're still going to have to live with them. We need to adopt this idea that we would much rather live with people who have received treatment and have been helped to not offend anymore, rather than living with people who we've provided none of that to.
Yes. And when I know a lot of people who've been abused as children, if they've heard that if someone is accused of this, they're going to be thrown in jail the rest of their life, they're going to be punished. Mm-hmm. Trying to report against your uncle, your father, you know, someone close to you, trying to come forward and say that this has happened, you've got this huge burden on you that you're the one that's going to be initiating this punishment and not initiating
right.
treatment.
Yeah, I mean, and that is definitely had a chilling effect on reporting. Definitely. I mean, kids don't have to be that old to know what the world looks like for sex offenders and, you know, how those people have been villainized and what that could mean if they are the ones to report, especially for someone in their family, someone who's close to their family. So, yeah, I mean, I agree with that completely. I think it has a chilling effect on reporting. And also, I think and sort of back to something you said about one offender having so many, having offended so many times, and sort of leaving a lot of survivors with a lot of pain, a lot of hurt. We also have to think about if you are a minor, or if you're just young and you've committed a sex offense. Because of that public perception as well, you're not going to tell anybody that you need help.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. If you turn it around,
yeah.
Why would anyone who has committed a sexual offense come forward and ask for help?
Exactly. It brands you for life in that way. And so, yeah, they're not going to come forward and ask for any help or any treatment. They're going to be afraid of being shunned, labeled as a sex offender, what that, you know, situation is going to look like for them. So then they receive no treatment and continue to offend.
It's discouraging.
It is, but I think the fact that we're having the conversation and the fact that a lot of other people, I think, are doing the same is hopeful. And that we're seeing that maybe some of our only focusing on labeling and, you know, so much effort going into the registry and into incarceration, that now we're sort of looking back and saying, how can we handle this better? So the fact that we're even having the conversation to me is hopeful, because 20 years ago or 15 years ago, we would not have been.
Thank you so much for your time, Ebony. What is the most important thing that you or your agency wants people to know?
You know, I think for every person to educate themselves enough so that they are or can be a support system for disclosure, I think it's really important. Handling a disclosure right way and being someone that someone else can talk to just makes, especially if you're that first person that they make contact with, is so significant in the way that that person or that survivor is going to approach everything related to their sexual assault. You can really make that much of a difference in someone's recovery that way. And I would also say having very open conversations with your kids about consent and being supportive of prevention programming in schools. You know, there's definitely work that we can do with the adults that we have, with the adults who are in systems and trying to prevent future sexual assault, but the more we can reach out to youth so that they are not in the situation as adults so significant, that really supporting those things is extremely important.
Thank you for listening to this segment of Criminal Sexual Conduct, What Needs to Change, produced by WUVS-LP and Connie Nesbury International, LLC. For full speaker bios and transcripts, visit ConnieNesbury.com, that's ConnieNesbary.com. Expressed opinions do not necessarily reflect the view of WUVS-LP or Connie Nesbury International, LLC. For support, call the RAIN hotline at 800-656-4673. Be sure to listen next time for more on this topic.